Welcome to IPEC Presents. Our podcast features research from the Institute for Policy, Ethics, and Culture at Michigan Tech, a public research university in Houghton, Michigan. I'm your host, Kendall Belopavlovich, and each episode of IPEC Presents is dedicated to discussing the research our institute conducts in service of policy implication, ethical considerations, and cultural significance of the massive changes and disruptive forces underway in our world. Our guest today is Libby Meyer, a teaching professor of the Visual and Performing Arts Department here at Michigan Tech, where she is also the director of the Music Composition Program and an executive committee member of IPEC. Libby holds a Doctor of Musical Arts degree in music composition from Northwestern University in Chicago. As a composer, Libby's music includes chamber, orchestral, choral, wind, symphony, film, dance, and theater. Her work has been commissioned and performed throughout the United States, such as a 2018 project for the new score of the 1925 film, The Red Kimono. She has served as composer in residence at Isle Royale National Park, and in honor of the 100th anniversary of the National Park Service released Lakescape with the Keweenaw Symphony. In a sentence, Libby Meyer is a composer whose work reflects the natural rhythms and patterns of the world around her. Welcome to IPEC Presents, Libby. We're so thrilled to have you on for this episode.
Thanks. I'm thrilled to be here.
All right. So first, I'd like to let our listeners know that you're a steward of the earth. And what I mean by that is that you're deeply committed to honoring, respecting, and protecting our world. It's clear from your work, but also from your lifestyle, which includes living on a small farm and tending to your animals and garden. Your work is deeply inspired by and infused with the spirit of the natural world. When and where did that start for you?
Probably in my childhood. My mom has a degree in biology, and so I did Girl Scouts and, you know, played with bugs and frogs and stuff as a kid in summer camp, and just a little, like, was the kid who always had, like, you know, no shoes on and okay. played in okay. the mud and stuff. And so, you know, I went to grad school, I don't know, like in the 90s, and I had to write a lot of music that I really didn't connect with because that was just the genre of the music. And then at some point when, you know, I think I can, like, fuse my different passions into my art, you know, because I was writing music that I felt wasn't really genuine mm-hmm. or expressing what I wanted to express. It was always what someone was telling me to express or
sure.
or what was you know, going to be the new style or the latest thing or whatever. And then, you know, flash forward a few years, I finished grad school and did an artist residency in Isle Royale and okay. Spent a couple weeks out there and went, oh, yeah, I think this is what I want to do. And, you know, got off the island and started just thinking a lot about, like, the kind of music I want to write and moved up here, actually, because of that experience and kind of didn't have a plan.
Okay.
But just that was probably, so it's probably like around 2000 that my music started to really kind of find its own voice. And I started to be much more interested in sort of, I don't want to use the word nature, but just sort of expressing the world around me, I find. Because I've written pieces about, like, my horse, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
so, like,
yeah.
or, you know, like, I find things that I'm interested in, mm-hmm. and then I try to express them musically.
Okay.
So it's kind of curiosity-driven,
right?
I guess. Yeah.
Right. So it seems like maybe, right, as you said, naturism isn't the right word, but relational, right?
Yeah.
Like, just being in relation and having connections.
Connection.
Yeah. You
yep.
reflecting upon that.
So my husband is actually an ecologist by training
okay.
and does work in land conservation and... So we have lots of conversations at home about this kind of stuff.
And, sure.
And in terms of how, like, everything is very interconnected.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is really interesting. And I find, like, connections between us and nature, but also connections with people. And so
yeah,
when I write pieces or work on pieces, I really am very particular about, like, writing for people. Like,
okay.
it's very rare that I will just write a piece. Like,
okay.
it's usually for someone or for an ensemble or connecting with the performer. And so to me, the performer and the audience is mm-hmm. very important.
Yeah.
Which, you know, going back to, like, the 90s when I was writing, the audience kind of got left behind in
okay.
the classical music world. Like, they didn't really matter. And I love where music is going now. And a lot of my, I would say, younger colleagues who are just getting out of grad school,
mm-hmm.
I feel like are writing music that's much more relatable.
Okay.
You know, and I think it gives me hope.
Yeah. So do you feel like is there a genre that captures sort of the music that you're composing now?
I mean, contemporary classical is sort of like the genre that I get. But, you know, genres are kind of weird, too, because there's so much overlap, you know. Yeah. So there's composers I like that, I mean, I guess they'd be considered classical, but if you listen to their music, you wouldn't think, oh, that's a classical composer, you know?
Right.
So, I mean, I think the genre is great for, like, record sales.
Yeah.
You know? But,
like a tag.
Okay, what do you write? You know, it's like, well, if you want a label, that's what I write.
Okay. Yeah. That kind of helps a little bit, because even though I listen to a lot of music, and one of my favorite Spotify playlists is called Classical Bangers.
Oh, that's so funny. I don't know what that is.
It's just like, I guess, like, really high intensity classical music, any sort of time period.
And
I didn't make the playlist, but I just found it one day, and it's been my favorite thing to study because it's just, like, so positive and upbeat.
Yeah. Well, and that's the thing, like, I feel like composers now of I would say, like, the millennial generation, I'm like, about as old as you can be and still be a Gen Xer.
Okay.
But they are, like, just stealing from everywhere, and I mean that, like, in the most positive way.
There's
a really fabulous composer down at Michigan State right now named Dave Biedenbetter, and he uses, like, heavy metal music in his, like, music, and it's great. It's music is music, and, you know, I think it's like, I steal bird songs, or, you know, I'll rip off, like, music from other things, or so it's kind of cool that, like, everything seems to be fair game now.
Sort
of infuse in your music, and it doesn't have to be this way, you know?
Right.
Which I think is kind of cool. I think it makes it more interesting.
I think so. I really love the way that you use the words, like, rip off and steal in a positive way. You know what I mean?
Totally positive, yeah.
Yeah.
There's a really tired old phrase, which is good composers borrow and great composers steal. Mm-hmm. Like, that's...
Okay.
Yeah, and so you don't steal a little bit, you steal a lot.
I think
nothing exists in a vacuum. And so, like, even my composition students, I always find, are very concerned with something being original and new.
Okay.
And I always am like, you don't worry about that, because that's, like, you won't write anything new.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's impossible.
I mean,
because music has been around too long. So whatever you've done, someone else has done it. And so if you make that your sole purpose, is I'm going to write this new thing, it kind of defeats the purpose of making art, you know what I mean?
I think
it's more about your voice, or expressing whatever it is you're trying to express, and not necessarily being so concerned with, oh, does this sound like somebody else, or is this new, or is it not new? Like, those things I don't think are really relevant.
Yeah, so I don't do music by trade, but I do a lot of, like, fiction writing.
I
can relate to that.
Yeah.
Like, very clearly, so my love is in vampire fiction.
Yeah.
So I've read, like, the gamut of young adult fiction novels to get inspiration, and then to find what little twists that I can make rather than trying to, like, reinvent the wheel.
I
can see how that's very relevant in the work that you're doing and what you're teaching to other people.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah, cool. Thanks.
So now that we're back from our break, Libby, I'd like to ask you, what is your favorite type of work to do, and what message does that work carry for you?
I love collaborating with people.
Okay.
So composition, like a lot of different arts, can be really lonely. Mm-hmm. You know, you spend a lot of hours. I mean, my workflow when I'm working on a project is I get up very early, and I have a writing studio, and I go out there, and I can spend 2 or 3 hours out there staring out a window, hoping that my muse shows up that day. And
right.
So it feels very lonely. And I don't know, I moved here. When I came here early on, I did a theater production. I did Shakespeare's Twelfth Night, and I fell in love with theater because I went, oh, like, this is the coolest thing, because you get to work with people.
Yeah.
And there's this whole collaborative aspect of it. And so I love that. And that's what I was saying before, how when I'm writing, it's very often a commission. And so I'm working with an ensemble, or I'm working with idea. And so that idea of, like, drawing on people's strengths, or what do you like to play? Or,
yeah, yeah.
So I just did the coolest project recently through Michigan State, actually, where it was called Falling Tree Collaborative. And
okay.
It was, they paired a composer with a plant scientist.
Wow.
And it was, I think it was an NSF funded grant.
Okay.
Through a an ecologist who worked, I can't remember what his specific study, something with plants.
Sure. Plant stuff.
But anyway, I ended up, there were so many cool things about it, but I ended up working with an agroecologist named Krista Isaacs, who does work in developing countries. And the project that I was really interested in was an area in India where it had the highest rates of abuse against women and or violence against women. And she did all of this work with teaching them how to develop seeds, and because it was an agricultural society. And
okay.
In that process of making them sort of knowledge keepers, it empowered them. And so... Okay. It was just amazing. And so, like, I used quotes from her research in the piece, because one of the things that really struck me is these women were like, people know my name now. And
yeah.
She said that really struck her, because it was like these women had been completely nameless. And yeah. So that kind of work was so powerful to me. And it was such an amazing project to, like, meet her and then, mm-hmm. like, write this piece. And then I immediately had this idea for what the piece was in my mind, and I had found these musicians I really liked, and so I met with the musicians, and mm-hmm. and some of it was improvised and some of it was written down, but it was sort of like, well, what do you, you know, what kind of music do you like to play, or what is your strength as a musician? And so I got to, like, express her work, which to me was just so meaningful and powerful, and then work with these really amazing musicians
who
are, like, doing these really amazing things. And it was great. It was on WKAR, whatever public television is in down there, and there's a link to it on my website. But I would say, I mean, the project I'm working on is always my favorite.
Yeah.
But I just thought that was, like, a very cool project. And then I just got a commission from a guitarist who's from Alaska, and he was commissioning composers to write pieces for guitar that sort of express Alaska. And I have spent some time in Alaska, and I'm doing a residency in Homer in the spring. And so I get to, like, explore the guitar, which is an instrument I haven't written for.
Okay.
And I get to, like, write about Alaska, which is a place I love.
Yeah,
and,
So you've been to Alaska?
Yeah. So I did a thing in 2017 called Composing in the Wilderness, where they take 10 composers to Denali National Park. Mm-hmm. And we work with, like, acoustic ecologists and all sorts of different kinds of scientists. We went with a moss expert. I know there's a name for that. Someone who's into moss.
Okay.
But, you know, and explored Denali and got to see parts of Denali that, like, nobody else gets to see, because mm-hmm. it was through National Geographic. And then we wrote a piece about it. And so that was the time I spent there. And then coincidentally, I got this residency in Homer, and so mm-hmm. I'll get to actually kind of go to Homer and sort of explore that a little bit.
Okay.
But yeah, so projects where I get to, like, learn things,
yeah,
I love,
yeah,
and work with people, and projects that have, I don't even know if I'm answering your original question, but projects that have kind of, like, an impact.
Yeah, so too. Write that part about, like, what message does that work for you? So it really is about, like, this impact and having this meaningful connection to people and places
and the various
things that are happening.
Yeah.
And, like, figuring out ways to communicate that through the composition of the piece or pieces.
This is a really long answer, but the other piece I actually have a piece being performed in Boston. And it's an older piece, but it, what I love about it is use a bunch of bird songs, and it has, I give bird calls to the audience.
Yeah, yeah.
And what's really, there's actually a video of it on the website, but what's really fun about it is I thought, oh, I would love to involve the audience in this somehow. And so I have this kind of morning chorus, and I went and got, like, those, like, Audubon, I don't know if you've seen them, but they tweet, and then there's, like, I had squirrel calls and owl calls.
Oh, yeah, I've never heard of that.
That's hilarious. So I handed it out to this audience, these little bird things that you fill with water and you blow on them and they tweet. So I handed this out, like, I had, like, 50 of these things. So I hand them out in the audience, and it was hilarious because, like, the piece is supposed to start, the violin's off stage, violin, and she's coming in, she's playing a white-throated sparrow call, and she's walking, and the audience is supposed to start, you know, like, and I said, part of this is about listening to each other, and they just went crazy. Like, they just, like, the guy had an owl call, and he was just, like, blast on the owl call. It was, like, so funny, and yeah. I was, like, but I was, like, oh, people kind of, I think, like, want to do this. They want to connect in a really visceral way to, like, the piece that's performed, and it ended up getting their, like, you know, audience favorite and got called back and stuff. And it's not even, like, a great piece, except it starts and ends with these bird calls. And I think people just loved that so much that they were, like, an active participant in the music and not just, like, you know, sitting there. So that's, I'm sorry, very long answer to question.
No.
But I also love, like, that kind of, like, the connection impact idea. So
right. So, like, having the audience sort of be involved with the composition and interacting. I think that's fascinating. I've never been like seated in an audience to do that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But like, I'm so intrigued. I'd love to.
Yeah.
And I think what's really interesting about the interactivity of birdsong, right, is because if you're thinking about like sitting in your home or your apartment or wherever you live, and you have the windows open and you can hear the birdsong
at any time
of the day.
Yeah.
It's such a beautiful honor, like in a very simplistic, everyday kind of way to listen to birdsong.
Yeah, yeah.
And to have that in the background is whatever you're doing, right? But then to be able to interact and call back, right?
Oh, and people were like actually making up their own bird calls. But it was really funny because like I just remember the owl call was like super loud. It was like a barred owl or something.
Okay.
And it was almost to the point where I was like, this person's going a little, like, too crazy. Like, but I was like, you know, if you hang 50 people bird calls, what they're going to do with it. So, you know, that's just what happens. But I have been to other concerts where there have been some kind of interactive, whether it's motion or whatever. And I think that that's, I think also just in the world now, the sort of those days of just going to a concert and sitting and listening to the concert, I think people want more of a connection. And so, like, I try to use a lot of imagery in my music too, because I think it helps people understand what the, it's why film works, right? And I think too, like, I always, when I do the new music concerts, I always want to make sure there's images. And part of me is like, if people aren't into the music, they can look at pretty pictures, you know, part of it. But I also think, like, if you're writing a piece about a place and then you have pictures of that place, I think it just helps them connect to, you know, oh, I hear the bird song, or I hear the wolf call, or whatever. So I think that helps too.
Imagery, you're having like something projected behind. Okay, all right.
Big
screen stuff.
Yep.
Yeah, there really is something transformative about watching something on a big screen or seeing something on a big stage.
It just feels
like a ceremony or a ritual.
Yeah, and I like music and image, or music and dance, or And it doesn't have to be accompanimental. It can be an equal partner in the art form. But I think that just helps. It's one more way for the audience to kind of connect with. I mean, sound is so abstract.
Yeah.
That I think sometimes having something really concrete, you know, like an image or something, is really, really helpful.
Okay.
So
you, I mean, your world is saturated by music and sound and like the thought of it and the doing of it and the being in it.
Yeah.
What are your favorite things to listen to in your spare time?
This is going to sound really weird. I don't actually listen to a lot of music at home.
Oh, really?
Partly because I think it, because for those reasons, I have composers I love. I mean, I love everything from Beethoven to Palestrina to John Luther Adams to Havanis to Ravel. I mean, so like Joan Tower, who I did my dissertation on. So like, I mean, there's a lot of composers I love.
Okay.
I actually listen to a lot of audiobooks in my car.
Okay.
And I think partly because I was having this conversation with my dad once, because he said he listens to Bach to relax. I listen to Bach and it kind of stresses me out because my brain is always like I have a hard time passively listening to music or like, I'll go get a massage and she's playing some, I don't know, like massage music. Like,
right.
Like, you know,
classical zen.
And all I'm doing is trying to figure out like what the chord progression is. And like, it just, you know, she's like, you're scrolling, you're scrunching your face up. And I'm like, well, because I'm trying to figure this out.
Right.
So I'm not like one of those people that listens to music to relax.
Okay.
And I try to be much more an active listener. That's just me. Like, okay. That's not. But I've actually talked to other musicians who've said the same thing.
You know, and I totally get it because the research that I'm doing is focused a lot on anime.
Yeah.
I don't watch a lot of anime anymore in my spare time. Because if I do and I turn it on, I'm suddenly like, this could be a research project.
Yeah, your brain just starts to go. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's not really enjoyable as a pastime anymore, even though it's one of my favorite things.
Yeah. And I'm like that too. I mean, like, music is what I do. I do have to say, if I listen to anything at this point, it's probably Irish music.
Okay.
Because that is kind of my love. And I go away and to it, or I'll listen to like composers that are friends, you know,
okay,
that kind, like people I know,
right? Yeah,
but yeah, it's, in fact, my husband loves to have music on all the time, and I'm always like, you need to turn this off.
Yeah, yeah, it's also kind of a censoring thing too.
Yeah, yeah,
be constantly saturated.
Yeah, yeah, it is
like that. So I have one more question before we pivot to talking about your involvement with iPad.
Okay.
And it really is just a silly little thing, but it popped into my head and now I just have to ask.
Yeah.
So do you have like a guilty pleasure, like trashy kind of genre or artist?
Oh my God. I love
like
80s music.
Okay.
Like I run to 80s music. Like on my playlist is like the Talking Heads. And
yeah.
Hair,
okay.
And like all of that. So, and I don't even feel bad about it anymore. Like
it's good to have balance, right?
And I do. I love like film music. I love John Williams, and I wouldn't even say there's necessarily a genre I don't like.
Okay.
Because I can always find something I like. It might be something I don't like yet because I don't understand it.
Yeah, I find that with a lot of music that I listen to as well.
Yeah, it's like, so I love Spotify when they throw these playlists at you and are like, even watching Saturday Night Live and watching some artists who I've never heard of that everybody knows who they are.
Sure.
But I mean, as far as guilty pleasures, yeah, I'm a child of the 80s, so.
Okay. That's very fair and very respectful. Yeah. But thank you. I just had to ask. So now moving into your involvement with IPEC, you're now on the executive committee. Mm-hmm. But I want to know, like, where did the journey with IPEC start and sort of where are you now?
So I knew some people on the executive committee, and kind of going back to when they first started the Tech Forward initiative, and sort of being in the visual, this is backstory. So being in the visual and performing arts on a engineering campus, we always sort of feel like the redheaded stepchild, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So like, and people don't know quite what to do with us.
Right.
You know, and so sometimes we feel like, oh, we're here to support other people or other disciplines
or other programs
versus just being, I would say, artists or researchers or whatever in our own right.
Right.
So
right.
I have sometimes feel like I have to justify the work I do by attaching it to something, you know, and I mean, there's valid, like I said, I love collaborations. And so the opera actually is a really great example of that. It's a collaboration with computer science, which we can talk about. But and so when all the Tech Forward initiatives came through, you know, it was very STEM, which, again, I get it. We're at an engineering school.
Right.
And there was the education one, but the IPEC was the one, it had the word culture in it.
Yes.
And I was like, okay, wait, I think I fit in there. And I had talked to Jennifer Slack, who was the former director. And I think I literally ran into her at the co-op, I think is what happened. And we had coffee one day, and I was writing a grant to bring a pianist here whose name is Samantha Ege, and she is, her area of research is historical Black women composers in the United States. And so, I had seen her perform, and I was just so into her work and how powerful it impact again, right? How powerful her work was. So I talked to Jennifer about like IPEC collaborating, and so we had a lot of meetings about it, and I was writing an NEA grant, and then Jennifer said, you know, would you be willing to be on the executive committee? And I was oh, sure, I've got all sorts of time. And so that was kind of, and then I think we spent, like, we were meeting a lot in the summer, and Sarah Green, who's also on the exec committee, is a good friend of mine, and and so, you know, again, it was sort of relationships and friends that were on it. And then I, you know, the speaker series was coming. And so I think it was just this idea of, like, this was sort of the one initiative that I felt like, this is, I think, where I fit.
Yeah, like connecting you to the greater campus.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Sort of like those bigger, like, label ideas that the university is working through.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so that was sort of how I ended up Yeah. And like so many things, I kind of fell into it. I was sort of was like, oh, I guess I'm on the executive committee now. And suddenly I'm at a meeting. And
yeah. And now I'm saying things, doing things.
Saying things and doing things. Yeah. And I felt like it was, you know, it had a pretty decent amount of resources to actually get some things done. And, mm-hmm. and I love the idea of sort of bringing visibility to, you know, the non-STEM.
Yeah.
I hate using that word. I don't know what another word would be, but, you know, I always feel like we have sort of this STEM, non-STEM divide.
We do, like, have this kind of divide. And one of the things that I really love about IPEC is the connections made that are bridging those,
yeah.
You know, communities and divides on campus. Because there's been plenty of times where I've had conversations with people in the humanities department, which is my home.
Yeah.
So, like, we're kind of lumped in together. So the humanities department and the visual and performing arts department are connected in two buildings on campus.
And they used to be the same department.
Oh, really?
Yeah, time. Yeah, it was all, that. Yeah.
Okay. So of course, we're even more lumped together.
Yeah.
Non-STEM thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I've had so many conversations with people on campus where it's like, they're having the same conversations we are.
Yeah.
But because of this divide, we're not really connected enough to have the conversations together and make a mutual beneficial relationship.
Yeah.
Or like forward momentum out of that.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think it's really amazing that you're on the executive committee and like you are having those conversations and you're seeing how to like plug in with the greater campus community.
Yeah. And that project I did down at Michigan State was such a great example of something like this. They actually have a center for transdisciplinarity down there. And one of the cool things going back to that project was there were four composers and four scientists. Mm-hmm. And we didn't just throw our names in a hat. They actually did a 3-hour meeting with all of us and asked us all the same questions. And they were questions about, I don't even know what the questions were, but it was so interesting because we all went through how we each answered the question. Mm-hmm. And the person that ended up being, who was my last choice initially, became my first choice.
Oh, wow.
To pair with. And I was her first choice. And it was so weird because it was not... She was the last, like the person that I thought I wanted to work with was not the person I wanted to work with. And it wasn't any person, but it was just, I found her work more, spoke to me more because she was the one who had like the, it was less science-y and more, she was actually a social scientist by training. But asking the right questions, I think is really important. And so like it was, in fact, after 3 hours, we were like, oh, I could do this for like another three. Because it was so interesting about like, A, learning more about ourselves because someone was asking us the right question, but also because how much similarity there was actually between, you know, like some of our answers were so similar. It was like, oh, wow, there's actually a smaller divide here than we think there is.
So. Yeah, because some of these big picture motivations that we have is just people who do things in the world.
Yeah, right?
You know, we have so many different labels and career tracks and things sort of put us into boxes, but really... We're all in Venn diagrams.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, exactly.
So I think it's amazing that you had that experience. Do you see any of that work being able to be put forward into Michigan Tech? Like, do you see any sort of collaborations?
I would love to do more work like that. Okay. I had never done a project specifically like that. Mm-hmm. With the new music series that I organize, I generally try to have some non-music component. And you know, like this year we're doing some stuff with computer science, and in past years I did a whole series called Rock Music, and it was music about rocks.
Oh, and that's so cool.
Yeah, it was kind of fun, and people kind of didn't get the joke, but I thought it was funny. So, we had, you know, geologists come in, and we did a concert at the mine, which we still are doing, and so I always kind of like to have some kind of collaboration with a non-arts, just to kind of show that collaboration.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, what was the original question?
You were just talking about
doing that
bringing it back to campus.
Yeah.
But you talked about the computer science
department. Yeah.
So what's happening with that?
So that is, I'm sorry, all my answers are really long.
No, it's
okay. There's backstory again. So okay. I'm also, one of my other jobs that I'm actually phasing out of a little bit is I stepped in and took over as a co-executive director of the Pine Mountain Music Festival, which is a summer festival. So, and that was kind of an interim thing for me.
Okay.
But we were looking for a small opera to do. And I have a really good friend. Her name is Elena Rouge. She grew up here. She teaches at MIT. Mm-hmm. So she's a composer in a STEM school. Mm-hmm. And she wrote this opera called The Thrilling Adventures of Lovelace and Babbage, which is based on the graphic novel by Sidney whose last name I am forgetting, Sydney. It'll come to me later.
Okay.
But it's a graphic novel based on the life of Ada Lovelace. And it has four singers and four players. So it's small. And I thought, okay, oh, we could do this Pine Mountain. And then I was talking to Linda Ott, who is in computer science, but also happens to be the chair of the board for the Pine Mountain Music Festival. Okay, and I'm telling her about this opera. And she said, well, you know, it's the 50th anniversary of computer science at Michigan Tech.
Uh-huh.
Wouldn't it be cool to have an opera be like the kickoff of like the year celebration?
Yeah,
and,
yeah,
you know, and have, you know, someone who grew up here, a woman who wrote this opera about a woman who was, you know, really involved in early computer science.
Yeah.
And, you know, a book written by a woman. So, I mean, there was a lot of this kind of cool feminine energy in STEM.
Absolutely.
And so it was kind of weird how it all happened, because we've been working on the project for about 2 years. And so I don't know if you know anything about this, but opera is unbelievably expensive.
Like, I did not
to
know.
Produce. Yes. Okay. It is not a cheap endeavor.
Okay.
And so I had to figure out how to get resources.
Sure.
So I basically, you know, went to different departments and kind of had my hand out and said, do you want your name on this? And so computer science stepped up, and so did the College of Science and Arts. And then I wrote a grant for the National Endowment for the Arts, and then they funded it. But it's just a very cool project, because it combines all these things, right? Mm-hmm. It's about and one of the cool things is Lovelace and Babbage had planned this difference engine, which is sort of an early prototype of a computer. I'm sure I'm using all of these words wrong, and Linda will cringe. But but anyways, the difference engine did not get built, but in their lifetime, but did end up getting built. So there's actually some recording. Elena, the composer, got to go to wherever this thing is and record.
Yeah, yeah.
Stuff. And, so it was premiered at MIT in February.
Okay.
And then we brought it out here for the Piedmont Music Festival, like a concert version. And it's a company called Guerrilla Opera, G-U-E-R-I-L.
Yeah.
And they're called Guerrilla Opera because they put up an opera, like they put up like four or five operas a year, which again is, in the opera world, is insane. Like usually you would put up an opera like in a year.
Okay.
And all they do, they commission new works, they do only contemporary opera. And so they did that, and then they're going to come and do five productions of it in October.
Oh,
it's going to be kind of the kickoff of the 50th anniversary of computer science at Michigan Tech. And,
okay.
There's going to be, and IPAC is actually a sponsor. IPAC is sponsoring some of it, and so I think there will be some IPAC kind of events and possibly some like panel discussions and about women in computing and music and all sorts of things. So it'll be kind of cool, because I think it's there's actually not women composers are actually, there are more of us, but it's also like when I was in grad school, I didn't know they existed. That's not me.
And we're back. And Libby, I want to ask you a question that I think our listeners will really appreciate. So we live in a world saturated by sound bites, 10-second clips, and highlight reels. How can we get back to listening to and making music with the world around us, even if we're not a composer?
Oh. I think listening has become kind of a lost art in some respects. And I think I'm only speaking for myself, but I think because I am guilty of this, I think we're uncomfortable with silence, which doesn't actually exist. But I think we're uncomfortable with out any kind of sound being made. So I think getting finding ways, whether it's through meditation or listening to music or whatever it is that works for you, but like finding ways to be more observant and aware, whether you use the word mindful or whatever, to maybe just be more aware of the sounds. There's a really wonderful composer who many people have heard of named John Cage, and he was like someone who I actually met him. He came to Northwestern when I was there, kind of near the time he died. But he had this idea of everything around us is music, and you know, when we think of what noise is versus what music is. And so someone once said, what is your definition of music? And you said, sounds heard.
Yeah.
Harmony is sounds heard together.
Interesting.
And I always thought that was kind of a really beautiful way of thinking about sound. And there was another composer who was sort of that vein. Her name was Pauline Oliveros, who has also died. And she did this thing called deep listening. She developed this idea of deep listening. And I took a deep listening workshop actually during the pandemic. It's through Rensselaer. And it's cool because there are people from all over the world, and we all meet on Zoom, and we do all these different practices about listening. And so there's lots of ways to think about listening to sound, and sort of, I think the easiest thing is to actually just kind of be an awareness, you know, sort of being awareness of those sounds, and maybe not placing judgment on them, you know, this is noise, this is sound. We're also, our world is also filled with a lot of man-made sound. And so I'm a big proponent of getting out into nature, going in the woods. I just got back from 8 days in Isle Royale. It's amazing, except that the plane all day long.
Yeah,
plane goes back and forth. Yeah. It's kind of a noisy place, but you know, getting to places, I mean, there's a reason why we feel better in the woods.
Yeah.
Lots of reasons.
Yeah.
But I also think, like, listening to each other.
Yeah.
You know, being aware of that. The music making part, I don't know. I think we should all be making music. I don't care if it's a kazoo or a drum or a piano or whatever. But I talk about this in my music and tradition class a lot, in that this idea of only certain people being performers. And you know, there's lots and lots of places around the world where music making is something you do to build community. And, you know, people used to sit on their porch and play the banjo and sing.
Yeah.
And it didn't matter whether you had a good voice or not.
Because we think about it in the United States as being like this very commercial.
You need to
make money with this.
You need to make money. You attach money. And I think people used to use music for all sorts of things. It was how we would grieve. I mean, if you listen to a lot of like Appalachian music, there's an incredible number of, I hate to say it, like songs about like dead children or, you know, like, or murder ballads or, you know, like ways for people to process happy things, but also sad things.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
So I think people get, it's going back to my students being worried about being original.
Yeah.
You know, how many people say, oh, I sing, but I'm not very good.
Yeah.
I play the guitar, but I'm not very good. And it's, you know, like, I love the fact that there's actually a ukulele group here.
Yeah.
Like in town, you know, they all get together and they play and they strum. And so I think, like, not worrying about, you know, like whether it sounds good or not. But I mean, I make my life in music. So of course, I'm going to say this, but I do think it's really valuable to do something, you know, sing, play the drum, whatever.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I have two things going off of that. So one, this first one is like the way that we listen to nature, and releasing judgment.
Yeah.
So when I was a kid, my favorite bird, because I love the color blue,
It's
a blue jay.
Oh yeah.
And so I grew up just loving to see blue jays anytime they popped up. It's just a really, really beautiful hello. And what I didn't realize is that blue jays, the sounds that they make are pretty obnoxious. And so when I realized that they have this very distinctive call, I was like, this doesn't match up to my childhood, fantasy experience of seeing this blue bird. But I've been able to reconcile that really appreciate the very distinctive noise that they make.
Yeah.
Because it helps me, because they have that distinctive noise, to recognize, oh my gosh, that's a blue jay. Even if I can't see, I can hear it. And then secondly, about being able to either sing or pick up an instrument, even if you're not great at it. So in the shamanic work that I do, I use a drum, and correct me if I'm wrong, but drums are like the oldest instrument that we have.
They're up there.
So one of the oldest instruments that we have. And what I really loved about learning about the drum in a shamanic perspective is that it's like the heartbeat of the earth. And I'm not good at drumming. But I can do it, and I do it with purpose. And so I think what you're saying is really valid. Like, even if you're not great, or you're not making money, or you're doing those kinds of things, listening to the sounds that you create too is really powerful.
No, and it's fun. So this music and tradition course I teach, one of the things we do, and it's an idea I stole from somebody, but they have to make an instrument, and it's funny because it's turned out to be like my favorite part of the whole semester, because I say
we're going to research some instrument, and then you're going to make an instrument. And, you know, some of the students come in with, a bucket or whatever. But I had a student build a guitar with his grandfather in a shop. That kind of stuff has happened in the class. But we do this thing where, I talk about John Cage, and we get together, and everybody kind of presents their instrument, and then we sort of play it.
Yeah.
And it's honestly, it's the last day of class. It's the coolest thing because, some of the students have come in. I had a student build a bass out of a shovel. I mean, it's crazy the stuff they've done. I mean, and there's cigar box banjos and stuff.
Of course.
But, a lot of them don't have a background in music, and they don't get an opportunity to actually just sit in a group and make sound on something. And I think it's kind of a powerful thing, especially if you're like in a group of people you don't know that well. I mean, it's such a great way to this is why drum circles are so popular, right?
Yeah.
So like I think it's a great way for people to kind of connect through sound, and you might not know anything else about these people, but you're making music together and you're listening to each other, and I think that can be, I mean, it's kind of like part of what makes us human,
right.
It's one of those, like, my cat doesn't sit in a drum circle,
Yeah.
Maybe she does. I don't know. But it's a very cool thing. And I kind of feel like, if you sat in a drum circle with someone, you gotta kind of like them.
Yeah.
Maybe we should all be doing more of that. I don't know. But yeah, I taught Suzuki violin for years. And one of the cool things about Suzuki is it's taught by ear.
Okay.
And the repertoire is the same all over the world. So, kids can go anywhere and they're all playing the same tunes. So like they can, Twinkle Twinkle Little Star is the one they all learn, but you'll see 500 kids, like none of them speak the same language and they're all playing Twinkle Twinkle Little Star. And it's like, it's a really cool thing, And like I've sung in choir, I'm not a singer, and I always love singing in choir, and I'm like between two really good singers, so that I feel like I'm a good singer because I can just and I love I love singing with people because I love that resonance and that like the harmonies and the clashing of the sound and the voices and all that kind of stuff. And I think that can be like a really powerful thing.
Yeah, like I've never heard a bad happy birthday being sung to somebody.
Bad happy birthday.
Yeah, I think that's a fantastic way to end that question and conversation. And when we come back from this break, we'll talk about those upcoming events.
Great.
So, Libby, as we end our episode today, I'd just like to ask you to plug the Guerrilla Opera, which is coming up. Could you tell us the name and then the dates and where it's happening, and then maybe a little bit more if you feel so inclined?
Great. Okay, so this is a really exciting project. We've been working on it I've been working on this for 2 years. So the opera is called The Thrilling Adventures of Lovelace and Babbage, and it's based on the life of Ada Lovelace. And for those of you in the know, and I did not know this anything about her, but she was involved in very early computer programming. And unfortunately, she died quite young. And so this is based on a graphic novel by Sidney Padua, who sort of reimagined what would happen if Ada Lovelace had lived, and used the difference engine that they built and used it to fight crime. So that's sort of the story of the graphic novel that Sidney Padua created. And then Elena Ruhr, the composer, who is actually grew up here in this area.
Great.
Yep, which is how I met her. And that's a whole other episode.
Okay.
But she teaches at MIT, and she was commissioned by Guerrilla Opera to write this opera based on this graphic novel. And so this was premiered at MIT last February, and it's coming here. The whole opera is coming here with the opera and the singers and the players, and there's dancers, and they will be performing it October. I have to look at the dates. It's October 12th, 13th, 14th, 15th. Okay. There's four shows, or five shows, actually, so there's two on Saturday. And Elena will be here. The opera company will be here. There'll be talks and conversations about it. The other really exciting thing is this is a huge collaborative effort between the Department of Computer Science, the College of Computing, in honor of the 50th anniversary of computer science at Michigan Tech, the College of Science and Arts, Michigan Tech Music. So it kind of takes a village.
Yeah.
And one of the things that's the most exciting thing to me in all of this is that the fact that this is the kickoff of the 50th anniversary of computer science at Michigan Tech, and they're doing it with an opera. And
yeah.
I just think that that's really exciting. And it also celebrates women in STEM, mm-hmm. Which is actually it's women in STEM, but women composers. There's not a lot of women. Most people can't name five women composers.
Right.
Most women, people can't name one. So I think that it's kind of a celebration of women in the arts and women in STEM. So mm-hmm. I think that there's a lot of really exciting things about it. It's only an hour long.
Okay.
It's hilarious. The singers are fantastic. The players are fantastic. They were here this summer, so I got to see a stage version of it.
Oh, you did?
Yeah. It was not a stage version. It was a concert version of it.
Okay.
And just it's going to be amazing. So everybody should come see it.
I think it sounds amazing. And also, like, what a treat that we have to have this amazing production that's going to come from MIT and all these different factors that are coming together. So yes, everybody go see this.
But it is kind of amazing that they are one of the premier producers of contemporary opera in the country.
Yeah.
When I wrote the grant and I called the NEA to ask about the grant, they said, oh yeah, Gorilla Opera, we know them.
So they're very just well-known.
They're very well-known.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's amazing. So again, for our listeners, this opera will be taking place in McArdle Theater on October 12th through Sunday, October 15th. And if you go to events.mtu.edu, you can find more information and also purchase yourself a ticket. Thank you so much for listening. Libby, is there anything else you'd like to say to our listeners before we end our episode for today?
Come see an opera. It'll be fun.
It'll be fun. Thank you so much. Libby's contact information and the Gorilla Opera event link will be posted in this episode's description. To all of our listeners, thank you for joining us for another thought-provoking conversation on all things IPEC, the Institute for Policy, Ethics, and Culture here at Michigan Technological University in Houghton, Michigan. If you'd like to continue this conversation, our email is also linked in this episode's description. The mission of the Institute for Policy, Ethics, and Culture is to promote research, policy engagement, and teaching that address the ethical and cultural challenges, implications, and strategies unique to the emerging technocultural environment. Michigan Technological University is a flagship public research university founded in 1885. We overlook the Keweenaw Waterway and join in community with the stewards of this land since time immemorial, the Ojibwa peoples. In our co-presence, we carry forward a commitment to listening, to allyship, and to joint stewardship.